VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on, settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books, contacts, calendar, double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility, there's more to iPhone.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow wherever you are. Tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Hello and welcome to the Game Podcast from The Times. Today we are talking Spurs, Aston Villa, Everton, Manchester United, Manchester City, Liverpool, a contender for Premier League goal of the season, maybe even of the century. Lift off for Luton Town at Kenilworth Road, a new league leader who somehow managed to be going under the radar. I'm Gregor Robertson, and joining me to discuss all of that are Tom Allnut, Alison Rudd and Tony Cascarino. First, though, we're going to reflect on the sad news that Terry Venables, the former England, Tottenham Hotspur and Barcelona manager, has died at the age of 80 after a lengthy illness. Venables, of course, led England to the semi-finals of the European Championships in 1996, memorably beating Holland 4-1 at Wembley before England were knocked out on penalties by Germany. He also ended Barcelona's 11-year title drought in 1985, becoming known as El Tel during his time in Spain, and won the FA Cup with Tottenham in 1991. Now, there are some beautiful tributes in today's times from Martin Samuel, Henry Winter, and our very own Alison Rudd, which I would advise everyone to go out and read today. Alison, you started your tribute to Terry Venables by saying he had a career you couldn't make up.
And well, that you should never try to either. I mean, you wouldn't create Terry Venables as a work of fiction because no one would believe you. So that's ridiculous. I mean, he was a very important figure in football, and he was England manager. And a lot of people today are saying he was the most inspirational England manager. But he also released a board game for all the family on how to be a manager. he wrote when he came to the end of his playing career with QPR. He decided he'd write detective novels. I mean, people don't do this anymore. And those detective novels were turned into a TV series. I mean, unbelievable. And he decided he was a businessman. He liked wheeling and dealing. So he bought a controlling stake in Portsmouth. When did he do that? While he was manager of the Australia national team. I mean, it's like he just couldn't do one thing. He had to be always trying to do other stuff. He failed in trying to set up a West End tailors. He was disqualified from company directorships for 7 years. I mean, it's sort of incredible that he did become England manager with all that behind him. And in his autobiography, he openly says he just was shocked himself that he was made England manager because, you know, the sort of stuffed shirts types at the FA did not like him being this colourful character at all. But Jimmy Armfield really, really rated him and did something quite brilliant, really. He went out into football, Jimmy Armfield, and he interviewed players and coaches from all over the country and asked them, who do you think should be England manager? And they all, not all, but most of them said, well, surely Terry Venables. And that made it difficult for the FA to say no. It was like they didn't really expect that to be what happened. So he was, it was almost a democracy in a way that he was sort of voted in to be the England manager. And so, but all of that is not, it isn't that long ago, but it seems slightly odd. These things don't happen anymore. And he just kept going. Always, you know, he could sing. He had records out in the charts. I mean, he could do anything. And so, whilst most of the tributes are focused on, I think his coaching methods. He was brave too. You know, he went to Barcelona. I mean, Tom will talk about this, but they didn't want him. I mean, English coaches were considered to be really quite rubbish. Why is one taking over at Barcelona? And he said, you know, get rid of Diego Maradona and bring in Steve Archibald. I mean, can you imagine how that would have gone down if it hadn't worked out? But it did work out. And by the end of his tenure there, they loved him. So what a colourful career.
A real personality then, Tony.
Yes. You forgot Al, the nightclub. His own nightclub as well.
Well, there's lots.
Which
more.
He used to sing in regularly and invite a lot of the boys that he obviously played with and he got to know over, from all different industries in different sports. I met Terry a few times through Ted Buxton, who is his right-hand man, who Terry used to say to me, well, he's still hanging on to signing you. He said, you know, that's all he's got, Ted. You know, used to joke about him. But also Teddy Sheringham played under him and Ted spoke very highly of Terry. He was an incredible character. He was my manager for the day because He was my manager for the day where I could play for the Republic of Ireland. I got invited across to play in Dublin for a game, and Terry Venables was the manager, and he had a Tottenham 11 for a John Devine testimonial. And I met Terry at the airport, but he also brought in some players from other clubs, like Steve Wicks was there, the centre half, the big blonde centre half that played for QPR. And we were sitting in the airport lounge, and I'm just from Gillingham, and I'm going over for this testimonial, and Terry's chatting all the way, and Steve Wicks sits next to me. Steve Wicks sits next to me and he starts to say that Venables is looking at him as a player to buy and had interest in him. And I just kept thinking, well, I'm up against you in the game. And anyway, I played and had one of my best games I ever had. And afterwards, Terry Venables didn't go for him, but he also said to me years later, he said, well, you give him such a hard time. He said, I thought, can't sign him, and you were a third division player. So he sort of nailed me in his way. But
shatterer.
Yeah, well, just that. But also, Mark Goldberg was my next door neighbour who owned Crystal Palace, and he brought in Terry Venables. But I'm told, and I asked Mark this, because I was told that even for, a meeting with Terry, it had come at a huge price. And I asked Mark about that one day, Mark Goldberg, and said to him, did you really pay quite an astronomical sum? He went, well, yeah, I did, but I'm not telling you about how much. He was an incredible negotiator. He was so shrewd. And I know he told loads of the lads after their careers, if you don't want to do something and you get offered things, just ask for three times much. You know, three times more. Ask for three times more. He was that guy. And Alison said he was that sort of Del boy, but a very shrewd man. Loved his football. And you speak to any player that played under him, and if Venables believed in you, you were his man. He absolutely gave you everything, supported you in every way.
Tom, you've lived and worked in Spain. As Alison pointed out, when he took the Barcelona job, it was almost at a time when English coaches were considered Luddites. what's the reaction been to this news in Spain?
Yeah, I mean, I think here in England with someone like Venables, there's always a sort of a temptation to draw upon all those stories that we've just talked about there, and to think of him as kind of a man manager and, you know, arm around the shoulder and this kind of thing. And obviously all that was there. But I think obviously what we've heard from so many people who worked under him was just how innovative he was and how brave he was, like Alison said. And I think it's interesting from the Spanish angle, they're not really drawing upon the sort of, you know, Del Boy kind of character. They're drawing upon his tactics and what he brought to La Liga. And when he first kind of came to Barcelona, this idea of kind of pressing and 4-4-2, it was revolutionary, you know. And you look at the papers today, Mundo Deportivo, you know, adios el mister, you know, bye boss. You know, there's a real big sense of feeling there, you know. And I think it's easy now to think of Barcelona as the kind of behemoth club that we know they are now. But at the time he went there, you know, they hadn't won the league for 11 years in his first season. They won the league at a canter. They were basically at the top since sort of, you know, day one. And so much of Barcelona's story is kind of seen through them winning their first European Cup in 92 under Cruyff. And Venables was a penalty shootout away from doing that in 86, you know, against AS Bucharest. And perhaps, you know, if they had won that penalty shootout, his place in that history would have been even more pronounced. But, I mean, this a nice piece by Ramon Besser in El País today saying he deserves his place in the kind of lineage of Gamper, Cruyff, Guardiola, you know, in the kind of identity of Barca that we know today. And remembered hugely fondly over there, absolutely.
And what you were at Tottenham Hotspur Stadium on Sunday, what was the feeling and the atmosphere like there?
Yeah, I mean, Paul Coity, the Spurs announcer, did a very good job kind of trying to give a brief summary of Venables' time at Tottenham, and he got through about 15 words before the whole stadium was basically standing up and applauding and no one could hear what he was saying. And there was a huge, you know, round of applause, of course. The South Stand kind of broke out into a chant of old Terry. You know, I mean, Postecoglou said it very well, I think. You know, he embodies almost everything about Tottenham. You know, brave, attacking football, gung-ho style, spontaneity. And, you know, of course, won the FA Cup as manager in 1991. So, yeah, I mean, the Spurs had an incredibly fast start in that match. And I think in part it was because of the kind of rousing sense of feeling before kickoff for Venables.
OK, well, maybe that's the best place to start, Terry Venables' old club. It was a fast start, but it was not the end that Tottenham would have liked and hoped for, and possibly deserved. It could have, you know, this was a thrilling game. It was like a game between two of the teams with the highest defensive line in the Premier League, and it was always going to look like it was going to be a cracker, and it turned out that way. I think Spurs could have been 3-0 up in the first 5 minutes.
Yeah, I mean, it could have been 2-1 in 5 minutes. So, I mean, there's so many goals disallowed. For a while, as you said, there's two high lines. It was almost like a kind of a series of balls over the top, players flying through, saves, offside flags going up. It was just, and Villa were playing on the tightest of margins like they do with that high line. And sometimes you could think, oh, you know, they were lucky with that one. But I think also, you know, sometimes you have to say it's really good defending. You know, they're very, very tight, very well organised. But Tottenham were excellent for the first half an hour. I really thought they were. I thought they played really well in that first 40 minutes, created loads of chances. It was the first game where I thought, well, they could probably do with Harry Kane here. You know, just someone with a little bit more kind of composure, a bit of pause in the box, you know, a little bit frantic perhaps. But they looked like they were going to go on and win the game, you know, comfortably. But, you know, we know Emery's like. He gets them into half-time. He very cleverly took cash off at half-time because he was on a booking, but he also said afterwards he wanted to sort of patch up that right side a bit, brought on Tielemans. And in the second half, I thought Villa were very professional, punchy, ruthless. We saw Watkins finish. I thought it was a really clever finish. And OK, a fair result might have been 2-2, I think, over the whole reflection of the game. But actually, I thought Villa really showed how, you know, we've talked to them before about how their patchy away record. They got thumped by Newcastle and Liverpool already this season, but they answered some questions yesterday, you know. And for people kind of doubting that Villa are going to be up there, Emery tried to claim afterwards there are still seven teams ahead of them in the race for the top four. But
who's he kidding?
It's getting harder and harder to sort of buy that outsider act, right? Because they're right there, in my opinion.
Yeah, they've won 7 of the last 9, 22 wins in 2023 as well. He is kidding us. He's kidding us on. He's trying to dampen expectations here, Alison, isn't he?
Oh, absolutely. But, I mean, how gratifying it must be if you're him, because you're saying the right thing, which is, I'm not going to... The last thing he needs is for his team to, A, start believing their own hype, the hype that's around them, or thinking about the bigger prize. That would not be productive, I don't think. So he's doing the right thing, but how gratifying for everyone else in the world to say, "Tuff, come on, you're in the conversation. You're definitely in the conversation." I mean, it was the offside derby, and they won the offside derby. Is how it felt to me, and Tom's spot on. It's about Spurs were all about chaos and emotion and going for it regardless of how many injuries they had. Whereas Villa, under Emery, were a similar team, but we'll rein it in and look at the finer points of movement and tactics and organisation and taking breaths. And that's why they won a thrilling game. They were prepared to sort of just... It's like when you're driving along and you just want to save petrol, so you brake a bit more than you normally would. I felt like Villa applied the brake occasionally and Spurs did not. And in fact, if you analyse what was available to both managers, it should have been the flip of that. It should have been Postecoglou saying, right, because we have 11 players out, was it 11? If you include
10,
suspensions.
I
mean, the team sheet was something else. There was no recognised centre half.
No,
Emerson Royal and Ben Davies.
A back four of fullbacks.
Yeah.
I mean, ridiculous.
No holding midfielders, you know.
And you keep Højbjerg on the bench. I thought Højbjerg did really well when he came off the bench. It made me think, why didn't he start?
But everybody's right. And everybody is right on board with this, aren't they, Tom? They're like, you know, as gung-ho as it seems, it's like there's no compromise, and it seems that the Spurs fans are happy with that.
But that's my point. Villa showed you can be, have an identity and compromise, and not...
But no one sat around this table saying,
oh, Aston Villa were really boring. What a shame they went all pragmatic. We're not saying that, are we? We're just saying they just included little elements of it to make sure they won what was a frenetic match.
But I mean, Emery, I think we know, is a very sort of reactive coach, and that's not, you know, that's not to criticise at all. No. He's a fantastic coach, very clever, but he will adjust his team and make those adjustments. Whereas Postecoglou is a Puritan, right? He's an ideologue. He thinks his way is the only way to play, and when
even with ten players out,
this is the way to double down. And actually, I guess he would say, yeah. I mean, I guess he would say that the previous week against Wolves, you know, they played Dier, they played Davis, they played Højbjerg, for example, and they actually played quite on the back foot, didn't really have much control of the game. And I think he looked at that match and thought, that's not the way I want to play, you know, and Dier back on the bench, Højbjerg back on the bench, and he sort of thinks, actually I would take some hits here early on in his Tottenham tenure, I'll take some hits, but we have to build the way we want to play. And I actually think, I take Alisson's points, but I do think long term the sort of Postecoglou project is still on track. You know, this thing is, you can see the way they're playing, you can see the identity, the way they played in that first 40 minutes yesterday was very good. They could have won this match. And would they have won it if they'd played a different, you know, played Dier and played back? And I mean, it reminds me a bit of when Pochettino took over. And when Pochettino came in, Spurs had a whole host of these kind of players, Kapu and Adebayor. And Pochettino gave them a few games, almost just to sort of prove him right. And then he brings in Ryan Mason. He brings in the sort of young British players. And he thinks, okay, this is my base. And it might not be good enough for now, but actually it's something that I can build on. And I think he thinks that playing a different way is, it might work a little bit here and there, but it's not something he can build on.
Maybe Postecoglou looked at the video of the Nottingham Forest game away from home, where Villa played recently, where the pace of Alanga and Morgan Gibbs-White on either flank, and also Wanyi down the middle, you're taking a huge risk when you're Villa and you're up against Brennan Johnson. Because one thing he is lightning quick. So is Son. But he's still, Unai Emery was still prepared. You mentioned there about compromise. I think that's one of the words of the season, because Jurgen Klopp doesn't compromise on Saturday with Trent. Didn't compromise. I'm still staying what I want to do. You know, he's doing it. Pep certainly doesn't compromise. I think there's a number of managers that have this mindset of, if we do this the best we can, this is our best way of winning points or getting points on a regular basis. So far, that served Spurs really well. If we'd have sat here at the start of the season and gone, after 13 games, Spurs would have this amount of points without Harry Kane, we'd have gone, well, no, they're not going to be there. And in fact, they are, and they've lost the last three games. So I found it a fascinating game. I kept thinking, what's the point of offside anymore? As I'm watching it, because it's, you know, they're literally on the line. I'm thinking, are they going to move the line soon? Because this is getting so high, they're literally going to be trying offside even in the opposition's half. You know, it made me laugh as I'm watching it. And it was an intriguing game. One thing that struck me is that managers, the sort of evolution of management now is that it's in game. It's time when you make decisions. The half-time has Tom alluded to, you know, decision making of Matty Cash, changing it around, getting Tielemans on into the team. Villa looked completely different. John McGinn's been terrific this season, but his first, if you look at his two performances, his first half and second half, John McGinn was terrific in the second half. And yes, the game was quite open, but the game's going to be open the way Spurs play anyway, and Villa. I thought it was one of them games I was kept thinking, the level of management now in the Premier League. Yeah. We talk about players that are being invested in, but the managers, you know, they've all had top careers. And a part of me kept thinking, do you know what? Is there going to be redemption at the end of the season for Unai Emery? Will they finish above Arsenal? You know, which, again, we would have never thought about that at the start of the season. But it's a little part of me thinks that, do you know what? Villa could end up above Arsenal by the end of the season. Now, I'd still say Arsenal would be the favourites for that, but compared to where Villa were, and look, Villa is a club I played for. So I've always got a lot of sentiment, a little bit of bias towards that club, because they've always, for me, been the biggest club in the Midlands, and they deserve a big team. And I think Unai Emery is developing a big team here.
It's not outlandish. They're 2 points behind Arsenal.
Yeah. Well, I don't quite say outlandish, but you know what I mean? We're a third of the way through the season now. 13 games is a third of the way through. So it's
Villa are very much part of that kind of shake-up for the Champions League spots now. Absolutely. I think that's what we can we can see after.
I mean, the one note of caution is that Tottenham are not the same Tottenham they were a few weeks ago. No. I mean, we are all talking about a statement win, and I said the same thing in my report, but equally, this is a great time to play Spurs, isn't it? I mean, playing Emerson Royal and Ben Davis at centre-half. They haven't got Maddison, Van de Ven, you know, no Romero, no Bissouma yesterday. I mean, they lost Bentancur after half an hour. They are really on their last legs, you know, so...
I do think, Tom, slightly... I do think it's not really that important, their defenders, because their style, as we saw, could have put them 3-0 up. And yes, I mean, it's a bit of a daft one to say they're not as important, but their style isn't really about their defenders being man of the match or being the performers that change the outcome of a game. It's all about how well their forwards can do and deliver, for me, of where Tottenham will end up.
But why do we think he dropped? He dropped Dyer, didn't he? Because he decided he'd rather have pace at the back than someone who knew what to do.
Yeah.
Mm. And I think that sums up Postecoglou.
Yeah, that's a good point. Let's move on. We'll move on to Goodison Park, where there was a kind of seething atmosphere beforehand. You know, pink cards held up with corrupt underneath the Premier League logo after following Everton's 10-point deduction for breaching spending rules last week. There were boos in the 10th minute. A lot of hostility. And that was punctured immediately by an absolute wonder goal by Alejandro Garnacho. Tony, ever scored a goal like that?
Have you?
Absolutely not.
In training?
No chance.
No, I've never done it in training either. No, couldn't do it. You know, agility to get the leverage and get yourself up in the air and then to hit it like he did. I mean, it was amazing. I mean, Sean Dyche must have been pulling his hair out thinking that is the last thing that
it's
we
true.
Need.
There was
worldy goal.
There was this feeling, there was yeah. real kind of sentiment in the ground that, you know, sense of injustice.
Yeah.
And
someone
that was the worst thing that could possibly happen to Everton, Alison, wasn't it?
Yeah. I mean, not in the script at all. Talking about you shouldn't make up a character like Terry Venables because no one believed he was real. This afternoon was supposed to be all about how Everton, the team, harnessed the atmosphere in the ground and the sense of injustice and the whole narrative of, and that is actually what Sean Dyche said was, you know, he's starting to talk like he's a Scouser. He's starting to talk about we have a certain way of doing things here, and this club will not be cowed by the injustice, and we will show it on the pitch, and we have to work harder to make sure that no matter what the outcome is when we've had the appeal, that we have given everything to make sure we don't go down. It was all set up for a rip-roaring match where the players found an extra 2% of adrenaline and pace and power and endeavour because the crowd would be roaring them on. That you know, the book was not written with a wonder goal from the opposition in the opening few minutes. That was not it at all. I'm not entirely convinced that's the only reason that Everton didn't play as we expected. I half suspect there was a fear beforehand amongst the coaching staff that if the players respond too much to what's going on externally, that you get a game which is too fast, too furious, and you get sendings off. You get people out of control. Like in the most heated derbies, suddenly they're ruined because two players are sent off and everyone's just gone a bit bonkers. I wonder if they were told, ease into it, don't let the injustice and so on get, remember that you're playing football, remember the tactics, just sort of ease yourself into the game. And they weren't ever able truly to connect with any sense of this is a statement game where we're showing that we are resilient in the face of what's happened with the points deduction.
Having said that, they had 20,
I thought they played well.
They had 24
they didn't play badly. They didn't play badly, but they didn't play with anything.
No,
it
wasn't expected atmosphere and sort of
they weren't
fury.
Different. No, yeah. There wasn't a fury.
No.
United kept giving them the sucker punch. You know, they got a wonder goal and then they get a penalty and, you know, they just, every moment you felt it was getting close to Everton equalising, Man United punished them.
Yeah.
Because it was never a 3-0, was it? You know, if you look at that game, it was never that type of match.
No. Right, the goal. Come on, where does this goal rank? Because it was an absolute worldie. And we've all been asked, haven't we, this morning to give our favourite or best Premier League goals. Tom, where did it rank?
I think it's definitely sort of in that kind of top 10, can I say that? I
mean, Not many.
In the Premier League, I think,
harsh man. Top 10.
I've seen some good goals in my time. I think, I always think the goals, yes, you know, the technical excellence and what the goal is in itself is obviously very important. But I always think that a goal has to mean something. You know, the context is important because we do see incredible goals, you know, in League One, in League Two, in you know, down the park on a Sunday morning. You know, but you have to have something where the stage is there. Where
like Wayne Rooney's goal against
City. Right, and, or even like Bale's in the Champions League final, for example, because okay. You know, it's one thing to kind of throw your leg into the air in a match which is slightly more low key. It's another thing to do it when the whole world is watching. So I think amazing goal technically, but I think there are some other ones where I think the moments were more important. But I mean, amazing strike. I mean, I always think with those goals, the same with Rooney, it's the sort of getting the feet in the right place just before, you know, seeing the flight of the ball.
Ground to cover actually to get into the right position,
and then not to get too close to it. You know, to slow down as well at the last minute to then allow you the space to fling into the air. You know. Brilliant.
But you've not answered because we have been given this task, haven't we, for the website today to pick our best goal in the Premier League. So what have you picked?
I picked Dennis Bergkamp against Newcastle because I just think that most of these won the goals all have replicas. You know, Rooney and Garnacho, Di Canio and Van Persie, even Beckham. We've seen, I don't know, Suarez and Figueroa out for Wigan and Xabi Alonso all score from the halfway line eventually. But no one has ever matched what Bergkamp did. You know, spinning it one way, swiveling the other and scoring. I just think we've never seen it happen. I mean, maybe you have. I've never seen anyone else do it. So just the uniqueness of that goal, I think, still makes it the best.
Alison.
Charlie Adam, come on. And you say, oh, everyone can score from the halfway line. He scored from 66 yards, actually. And the reason is, this was in 2015 at Stamford Bridge when he was playing for Stoke. And the reason, if I'm honest, the reason I'm calling it the best Premier League goal is, A, I was there, and I think that matters. And also, I had genuinely been nudging people in the press box and slightly annoying them by saying, because I'm a big Charlie Adam fan, you see. And I was saying things like, I can tell he's going to do something great today. He's in the mood. I can tell. I can just tell by the look on his face. Oh, the way he's strutting around. He's going to do something amazing. And then he did do something amazing. Well, I felt blooming smug, didn't I? But and then people were going, wow, you saw that coming? That was weird. But it was astonishing. And he said afterwards, oh, I just saw. And it's Thibaut Courtois, who's one of the world's best keepers. It wasn't some silly little cup game where the keeper's a bit short and off his line. This is one of the world's best keepers, was just slightly off his line. I'd noticed he didn't do that before, and so Charlie Adam thought, next time I'm going to have a go. And he had a go from 66 yards out, which is phenomenal. And it was beautiful, and his left peg is a gorgeous thing. And the way it... I mean, that's such a long way away that the ball's in the air for a long time, so you're sort of going... It's like a cartoon. It's like it's not real. It was absolutely stunning. But I do admit I had soft spot for Charlie Adam, which informs that choice, and I was there. So maybe it wouldn't have been that. But I felt really privileged to have seen it and felt that it was, you know, in the air that it was going to happen.
Go on, Tony.
Well, I understand all the, you know, the idea of the importance of the game. Because I would have probably, if I do that, would have probably gone the Henry against Man United when he left Barthez, who he was in the French team with, literally flat-footed, and he's literally picking it out the top spot, you know. But if I'm going for a goal, it's only because I'm in the centre-forward union here, is that Peter Crouch shouldn't be scoring the goal he got for Stoke. He cannot score that goal. I mean, you know, he's 6 foot what? 5'6"? I don't know. What is he, 6 foot six, Peter? I mean, ridiculous. For him to do what that, get that type of goal where he's literally at an angle, as it's dropping, he just hits it and it is literally postage stamp. And I've always said that goal from a big centre forward, because I don't know how many big centre forwards could get there, because I certainly couldn't get even close to that. Again, going back to my training days, I wouldn't have done that in training as well. Peter Crouch's goal, because I still to this day think it's one of the greatest strikes I've ever seen.
So and Stoke seem to be winning.
Well, sorry, actually,
winning the wonder goals of the year.
My vote was Bergkamp, because I was there completely by chance, and I kind of agree with Tom. It's about,
was it a bad touch though?
But it's like there's a lot of these goals are like shocking, like jarring. Like this was one of those where like an overhead kick, it's like pow, whereas this was like
subtle.
Wow, it was like it almost took. Like several seconds for it to register what he had done. It was like,
is that slow motion, Gregor?
Has he just done that? So it was just, you know, a defied belief, really. Yeah. So I would go with Bergkamp too. But this, look,
Di Canio's was great as well.
Absolutely, yeah.
That volley. I mean, the length of the ball that it went to get to him.
Yeah,
and
because
Van Persie's was with his left foot, right? But Di Canio was actually coming out from the wrong angle almost with his right, from what I remember.
Yeah. Yeah,
pinging it into the far post. Yeah, that was a great goal as well.
This will certainly be talked about for many, many years. United, Tony, this is their fifth victory in the past six league games. That blew my mind. And they're only 6 points behind the leaders, Arsenal. Obviously head to Istanbul this week for a hugely important game in the Champions League. What are we learning about United? There was a great performance by Kobbie Mainoo, an 18-year-old midfielder who stole the show,
terrific.
Really.
Yeah, Harry Maguire as well, I thought, centre-half, handled Calvert-Lewin very well.
But it was an odd performance. It wasn't, as you're saying, it wasn't a 3-0.
No, it was never like a 3-0 kind of performance. Them. And United fans, I know that they listen to this, they might think we're a little bit biased and... But then, you know, there's not much you can compare with United teams from the past and with when they had successful sides. What I did think is that everything that happened in the game for them happened seemingly, you could argue, well, any time's a perfect time. But it just said every time Everton sort of got going, United got another goal.
Yeah.
I thought the penalty was quite harsh, even in commentary when Gary Neville was describing it. I thought, these type of penalties are given so easily now where... You know, Martial's touch got away from him. You know, that was, he was never, but he's looked for the line of Ashley Young, gone over. But it's really hard to criticise teams when they go to a Goodison Park and say, you know, they've won 3-0. And then afterwards go, yeah, but they're not good. They're just not. Marcus Rashford, for a period of the game, was Everton's best player. He kept giving the ball to Everton players. And, you know, and Marcus isn't like he was last season, quite clearly. And his confidence has been affected. I thought, if you're going to take anything from the game, I did think they defended really well. Luke Shaw coming back into that team on the left-hand side was a big plus for them because he was a bit more of a safety net. Tough because it was never a 3-0 for me.
Alison, final point on Everton. The only team to have 4 points or fewer after 12 games, so that's before this game, to avoid relegation was Everton in 1994-95. Do we think, you know, now that we're going to go on to talk about Luton's kind of lift off at Kenilworth Road after the break. You know, suddenly, you know, everyone thought Everton will be fine, but now the five point gap have opened up. Bournemouth have found a bit of form. Luton have shown that they've got spirit and they'll take them all away. It's not going to be cut and dry for them, is it?
No, absolutely not. And they'll, I think Dyche and his team are going to have to sit back and think again how to navigate this, because it's difficult, because they could yet get some of those points back. Right now, as we sit here, that there is an overwhelming sense. I mean, when the news broke about the 10-point deduction, the mood music was, well, if you break the rules, bad things happen. But now it's changed, and I think most pundits and people involved in the game are thinking that's too harsh a punishment. And you can't apply punishments when you haven't set out initially what they were going to be. I mean, Everton had no idea that what they were doing would lead to a 10-point deduction. It's really, really... In football, if you're refereeing a game, a player does something that warrants a yellow card, but then before you had a chance to mention it to him or do anything about it, he then commits another foul, which is also a yellow card. You are not allowed to give him two yellows, because the player has the right to know that he's on a yellow before he commits the second offence. And this should be applied in this instance. Everton thought they knew they'd done something, things weren't going well, they were trying to, with the Premier League, find a route out of the imbalance in their accounts. They had no idea while they were doing all that by the end of it there would be a 10-point deduction. They probably thought they were going to get fined, and then they thought maybe we'll get a couple of points. Most people now think it's an injustice, so there is a possibility that the 10 points will not be 10 points. But from a footballing point of view, as the coach, do you have to tell the players at every session and before every match, let's assume we are where we are in the table, let's not get sidetracked by rumours that the 10 points won't stick? And then you have to, that sounds quite depressing though, doesn't it? Let's say it's going to be 10 points, how do you turn that into the extra motivation to play better, to defend better, to score more goals? How do you turn it into that? Well, their first opportunity, as we've said, they played okay. They played okay, but they didn't quite translate that indignation into fury, as you put it, Gregor, on the pitch. So they're going to have to find a way. And I think that dilemma, all that mixed up together, is probably what might be, strangely, what undoes them if they don't find success with their appeal. Because it's really hard to know what to do with all the information. What do you do with it?
Also, at what point does the sort of indignation have a tipping point and then it kind of becomes deflation? You know, I think we sort of, everyone was talking this week, I think everyone was expecting Everton to win this game,
yeah,
because everyone was
thinking
there's going to be this galvanising effect, there's this fury, there'll be the fans, you know, we're going to see Everton come storming back. But what if it doesn't happen? You know, what if they have a run now of two or three games where they lose all three, and then they suddenly think, you know, and all that kind of fury actually just becomes a bit of disappointment, feeling the victims, feeling like, oh, everyone's against us, you know. And I think that's going to be hard for Dyche to manage, because we all assume that there would be a kind of a kick in and a bounce back. But if it doesn't happen, then it could quite quickly feel like a real sense of disappointment around the whole club, and that would be difficult for him to bring back.
Well, it certainly made things interesting at the bottom of the table, and that's where our attention will turn to next. Still loads more to come. If you're enjoying the podcast, make sure you're subscribed. Just go to thetimes.co.uk/thegame for the latest subscription offer.
As you're listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. It streamlines your processes to make your business more efficient, which makes you less busy. Mail checks, invoices, legal documents, and everything you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. Seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart. Schedule package pickups and see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers, with rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS rates. And with the Stamps.com mobile app, you can take care of mailing and shipping wherever you are. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up with code PROGRAM for a 4-week trial, plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's Stamps.com. Code PROGRAM.
Hi, I'm Jane Garvey.
And I'm Fee Glover.
Off Air with Jane and Fee is going live.
We are taking to the stage at the amazing Crucible Theatre in Sheffield on Friday, the 31st of May.
It'll be a night full of surprises. We'll have a special guest, we'll involve you in the audience, and we'll embarrass ourselves. You really won't want to miss it.
Well, the surprise is we don't yet know what's in it, so it genuinely is a night of surprises.
Well, you've surprised me already. It's not just us. Our live show is part of an exciting new podcast festival called Crosswires, which is taking place in some really amazing venues across Sheffield from the 31st of May to the 2nd of June.
So other podcasters that you'll be able to see include Katie Price, Catherine Ryan, Ramesh Ranganathan, and the original Adam Buxton. But there's also a whole host of free fringe events, family shows, surprise acts, and after parties that Jane and I haven't yet been invited to.
I'm sure it's only a matter of time. Head to crosswires.live for tickets and more information.
Welcome back to the Game Podcast from The Times. I'm Gregor Robertson. We've just had to bid farewell to Tom Alnett. Alison Rodd, Tony Cascarino are with me. Next up, Kenilworth Road. Lift off for Luton Town, Tony. It's making things really interesting at the bottom of the table now, actually, because, as we said, there was a sort of expectation that the three promoted teams were done for. Then Everton, Luton were slapped with a 10-point deduction. Luton and Bournemouth as well, who were kind of the team who everyone expected possibly to flirt with relegation as well, have both found some form recently. And this was a really, really important moment for Luton Town season.
Yeah, and it sort of started with the Liverpool game, didn't it, when they got a draw at home and lost in the last few moments. Well, I said this at the start of the season. What will be Luton's, obviously, season? What's their biggest chance of staying up? Because it's a massive challenge for Luton to stay in the Premier League. They are clearly not a club that can go and spend millions upon millions and have a structure in place to be competitive as a side. They're just a well-drilled team, a tight-knit group that are going to give their all in every game. So that will give them a chance. And they will upset and give a few teams bloody noses, as Crystal Palace found out at the weekend. That's what Luton are capable of. You know, and I'm not taking anything away from them, but they are built on a side that is really from players who have been down the lower divisions, who have come through, you know. And I feel that in itself... My first season in the top flight was with Millwall, and we got promoted, and we all had a point to prove. And we were terrific in that first season when we got into the top flight, Division 1 at the time. I remember thinking, we have to have that the next season. If we lose that, we're relegated. We lost it, we got relegated. And this is how I see Luton. They can't lose hunger, desire, motivation, everything that you'll need to get them extra points. And this is a perfect example of the game and the way they won it, the manner they won it. Fair play to Rob Edwards and his team.
The reason I think there's a chance, I don't think it's a huge chance, but I think there's a chance that Luton will stay up, is that they play for the full 90, 95, 101 minutes. They're not... If things go against them, they're really level-headed. So they can concede... But they don't act. They don't. You don't see that sort of shoulder drooping. You don't see concentration dipping.
Well, there's never been a capitulation. Not even a subtle one.
No. And so if you compare Luton with the other teams that are considered vulnerable, they Sheffield United, they do look crushed occasionally, and they suddenly implode as well. They're capable of doing that, and I just feel Burnley, you know, they are infuriating because they can play football at Burnley, right? They've got a good coach, they can play football, but they haven't quite yet mastered the art of it's a game that lasts as long as it lasts, and things will happen that you're not expecting, and you have to be level throughout. You have to have the same level of desire, belief in your system, just belief. I think that's down totally to Rob Edwards, actually, from what I've gathered from info from the training ground and so on. He's just very good at making sure they know who they are, they're very calm. If they were to go down, I think they'd probably be the most calm and grown up relegated team I've seen. They're small, lack of resources, as Tony's pointed out. They've got all the excuses to hand for going down. And when they came up, most of the fans were saying, we're going to enjoy it. We don't really expect it to work because of how small we are. But they do have this aura, seems an odd word for a team that are near the bottom. But they do have a calm and a sense that all things are possible. And that draw that they did get against Liverpool, they can always keep drawing on that. Mm. Always keep drawing on that. We matched Liverpool. We matched Liverpool. So no matter what happens from now on, they can always draw upon that. And yeah. I think there is a reasonable chance if they can maintain. And I see no reason why they shouldn't maintain that attitude, actually. Why would they stop?
There was a lot of late goals at the weekend. You know, the Fergie time sort of thing that only happens to the teams at the top end of the table. They're going to have to avoid that. You know, as a team that's fighting relegation, you can be, as Alisson said, being that 90-minute or 95-minute team that just keep going, that you're not the team that concedes then, like Burnley did against West Ham. Two late goals. Yeah. You know, in a great position, two late goals.
I mean, in fairness, did you see Jefferson Lerma struck the bar with a header in like the last minute of injury time? It could have been very different.
Yes.
The goalkeeper had another great performance. So they kind of rode the luck towards the end. But you're right, they kind of, we're seeing a bit more, they're growing into a sense of belief that they can do something this season, I think. So what about Crystal Palace? I mean, another contender for goal of the season by Michael Olise. Huge to have him back in the team, but lost Eze and Doucouré to injury. 15th, won one of the past six games. Could they, Alisson? Could they get drawn in?
I just think there are teams worse than Crystal Palace, managed by managers not as good as Roy Hodgson. But that is a massive blow to Corey's serious injury. That's the heartbeat of their midfield gone.
Mm.
And I think all the focus for a long time with Crystal Palace has been on their attacking players. So when they had Eze and Alisi out, it was all about chug, chug, chug until you get them back. But they were doing okay with them out, actually. They had a way through. But the key to Palace is always the defence and the midfield. And Doucouré will be a massive blow. I don't think the Eze injury is as serious as Doucouré, so hopefully he won't be out for too long. But no, it'll be a blow, and they'll probably flirt with people saying, oh, look how close they are to the drop zone. But they'll be too much now, it's too much experience, too much defensive nous as well from Hodgson for them to go down. But I actually thought there were points in this game where Palace did play really well. They did play really well. And it was just injuries at the wrong time in the game. And as you say, hitting the woodwork as well. They were unlucky. But I don't know, Tony, do you think they could possibly go down
Palace? No, I don't. I don't see that. Look, the guy who's the manager was brought in last March to stop them going down, and that's exactly what he achieved. I always feel there's a negative running through this football club. It's all about Roy for the year and what we're doing, and we need to move forward. I'm surrounded by Crystal Palace fans where I live, and it's always, yeah, but, you know, Roy as a manager, we have to think further down the line, and I always feel Roy's battling against that as much as how his team's doing. There's always that agenda of, well, we should move on, and it was good under Patrick for a certain amount of time, Patrick Vieira, and then when it did go wrong, we had to bring him back to keep us. But they're thinking again this season, yeah, but we've got to get a manager for next season. So it always feels like Roy's battling against that for me. The winning goal was a bit of a harsh one, because one of their best players is Anderson, and he gets caught with his goalkeeper, indecisive, from across. You've been there, Gregor. When your goalkeeper, you think it's your keeper's, you think it's his right to come and get it. He doesn't. Then he gets a little bit flat-footed because he thinks his keeper should probably be there. And that's cost them in the game. With getting Elise back is a big plus, because he can do that. Always juggle between seeing Eze and Elise, who's the most gifted. And I actually think Elise is the most gifted, but I don't know if he'll reach the numbers of... Elise is the most gifted, but I don't know if he'll reach the numbers of Eze by the end of the season. It's a game that I'm sure it will really grate with Roy, because they survived by getting results against teams that were around them last year, and they did that very, very well. So this one would have been quite painful for him.
And yet, Luton did get a draw with Liverpool. It's not that embarrassing.
Yeah,
to lose in an unfortunate manner with injuries.
Do you agree, though, Al, with the narrative around Roy and always, the short-term and long-term view of Palace fans? Because it feels like he's battling against that, and he doesn't want to battle. He just wants to be, I'm the coach, I want to be judging how I've done, I'm 76 years old, but that shouldn't really matter either.
Well, I'm surprised that they are still banging on that door, actually, because in this stint, with the flair players he's got and some really good defenders. I'm a big fan of Anderson, for example. Yeah. He's excellent. They do play attractive football. It's not all dour stuff. There is quite... Mm. I mean, we thought we'd seen goal of the season, but then we saw Garnacho's goal, so it wasn't. But, and we'd have been talking about that goal more, actually, wouldn't we?
Yeah.
But they... I've seen a bit of Palace. I've been entertained each time. I think people get a label... And the label is that Roy is pragmatic and built on defence, and therefore you're not going to see good football. But you do see good football.
Yeah.
Because Roy also likes and wants to encourage the young flair players in the team. He was delighted to come back and have those players in his squad. If I was a Crystal Palace fan, obviously very annoyed that we've lost at Luton Town and given them their first win in the Premier League. That's a bit humiliating. But overall, you get a lot of entertainment with Palace.
Mm.
It's not... It's not, they're not going backwards.
No, no, no. I'm just surrounded by people who watch every game, and they would beg to differ slightly. But I am with you. I don't look at a Palace side that I think, oh no, these are dreadful to watch. I don't think that at all. I actually think there are moments of brilliance within their team, and they defend very well. You know, at times two centre halves, full backs. I think Roy's created a much better team than he took over from Patrick Vieira last season.
Well, one manager who was thinking that he watched something pretty dreadful was Mauricio Pochettino, whose Chelsea team lost 4-1 against Newcastle United at St James's Park. Alison, this was an eye-catching result, but also a bit of a chastening one for Thiago Silva, who, you know, Tony, you've written about this. So I'll speak to Tony first. You've written about this in your column. A couple of players who may be beginning to show that they're on the wane, you know, because of their age, actually.
Well, I didn't want it to sound like this is a knee-jerk reaction to a performance, because anyone can play badly in any game. But there has been signs of, obviously, Thiago Silva this year. He's incredibly gifted, but he's 39 years old. And there was times in the game against Newcastle where he gets caught. And he got caught by Anthony Gordon, obviously. Joe Linton as well, yeah, in the game. So he was caught a couple of times. Thiago, I mean, it's a great example of, look, if he can't play out from the back, don't ask goalkeepers, because Thiago Silva is as gifted as they come. And I've always been a massive fan of his. But I just felt, and you've been in the game, we've all been there and played, where some people's legs go at different times. He's got to 39 with really his legs not going. But there is a split-second decision there, and I mentioned Ashley Young in that as well, where mistakes happen because you are coming into literally the final furlong of your career. And I thought it showed. He looked like a 39-year-old on Saturday. You know, he's played back-to-back games with 8 goals conceded as being the main centre-half in them 2 games against City. And, you know, and again, there was mistakes in the Chelsea-Man City game. And that I don't associate. That's 2 pretty indifferent games from Thiago Silva, back-to-back. You know, conceded 8. I'm not sure if it's... You've got to look for a different direction. Certainly by the end of the season, that will happen. And why not, being 39 years old? I just thought there were signs of it in the game.
Alison, but Poch was pretty scathing of his players after this. Martin Hardy's written about it in the game today, about he's kind of, you know, juxtaposing Eddie Howe's positivity and speaking up his player's character when he initially took over, about the same point, I think they're 13 games into Poch's season. And this has kind of seemed to be a huge step backwards, and he really was calling his players out and saying this is not good enough, and he was talking about character, actually.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think this is a pretty significant moment for Pochettino. Pochettino has had a lot of problems with expensive players being injured and promising players being injured. He's had to juggle, and even you know, at St James's Park, he didn't have what he would consider his first choice team. But Eddie Howe had 10, 11 players out. He'd had that many out in the game against Bournemouth, and they'd been disjointed, but they had shown a lot of character, and he'd worked, found a way through within just the space of one match. He'd found a way, Eddie Howe, to make a team shorn of a lot of its best players, having to move pieces around to make sure that self-belief, character, personality, effort, cohesion, you can get it even when you've got problems. And that he's done that in the space of a few weeks, whereas Pochettino has struggled all season to make a team out of similar problems to the one that Newcastle has had. And so he sat in the stands, Pochettino, because he's suspended, and he's watching this unfold, and he probably can't believe his eyes that Newcastle have won a game they really shouldn't have won, given the problems they had and given the performance they'd had just before the international break. They should have been ripe for really tearing into. You know, you've got someone making their second Premier League start in midfield. It's looking a little bit not.
He was terrific, by the way, Lewis Miley. He was terrific.
Well, then why can't the people who step up for Chelsea to have the same impact? That's what Pochettino's seeing unfold in front of him. It's the comparison, really, that he can't get them to be cohesive and give everything in the right way. And what made it even worse was he saw someone trying to give everything, but in the wrong way, in the form of Reece James, who's the captain, and probably thought he had to show that he cared. This often happens when it goes wrong. You end up getting sent off because you're not doing it in the right way at all. It comes across as petulant as opposed to passionate. So I'm not at all surprised Pochettino lost his rag, because it's just the comparison was just so stark. Two teams with injury issues, and one team showed that it doesn't matter what problems you have. If you can get 11 players out on the pitch, they should be proud to wear the shirt. They should know what the system is. They should have a sense of identity. They should want to work incredibly hard. And Chelsea, whilst there were individual performances, like Raheem Sterling looked good, I thought. Individual performances were okay. They didn't have that sense of cohesion. And it's reminded us that whilst we were all, you know, gushing and gurgling over the 4-4 between Chelsea and Man City,
it's chaotic.
Chelsea were at home and they did concede 4 goals. Yep. So, you know, the team hasn't passed a test for Pochettino yet.
Yeah.
And if he thought they had, this proved that they haven't.
It was interesting, Reece James's performance, because he clearly was unhappy with Anthony Gordon, who seemed absolutely up for the game. And you end up getting frustrated, you know, as a fullback or wing back. And that stood out for me, that the moments in the game where Anthony Gordon was just like, you might not be fit enough to be in this game today. Do you know? Because when you come back from injury, you know, you get through the training sessions, you get there, and then suddenly you're a little bit off it. And he sensed it. Anthony Gordon sensed it from the very off.
He doesn't give you a moment's peace
either. No, and he's quick and he's direct. And he, like you said, he just won't let you sit on the ball and be comfortable. And I think Reece James realised quite quickly this was going to be a tricky afternoon. And maybe, you know, in hindsight, you could probably say to Poch, well, should you have put Reece James in? I know he played in the game against Man City and played, I think, 70-odd minutes in that particular game. But he did look like a player that had been injured, come back. You know, he left the England squad just recently, didn't he? Didn't go on international duty. You know, Reece is fighting for his right back spot, if you like.
Well, result left Chelsea in 10th on 16 points, 7 points behind Newcastle, who are in 7th. And the battle at the top of the table between 1st and 2nd probably says it all, that we're coming to this game last. It was a bit underwhelming, wasn't it? After we talked up so much, it was 1st versus 2nd. Not anymore, of course, because Arsenal have leapfrogged both Manchester City and Liverpool. But we'll go to the Etihad first. What do we think? It was underwhelming. The big news was Haaland hitting his 50th goal in 48 games, which I think is a joint record in the top flight. Trent Alexander-Arnold looking like he's growing into that kind of inverted full-back midfield role, getting the equalising goal. That's probably the two standout points, but it was a bit of a cat-and-mouse game, wasn't it?
Okay, well, I tell you what I found really interesting, and I mentioned this about Trent, is that, you know, he clearly gets targeted where he plays, because Doku and Bernardo Silva were literally put on that left side, and Mo Salah isn't asked to double up and help him, you know, and because Klopp wants to play that. If they get the ball, they get it to Salah really as quickly as they can. And yet Trent really had a two against one, and look, he's going to get, sometimes people are going to skip past him because he's quick, but he's not as quick as Doku, and he's not as quick as some other wingers. I remember Vinicius Junior skipping past him a good few times. You know, he's not got that Cole Walker sudden burst of speed and strength that can handle it. But staying in the game, and Trent is such a gifted footballer that he'll still produce crosses. He'll still have an impact in the game and still deliver something. And that's what I thought was really intriguing about the game, that how Trent gets targeted, because Napoli did it. When Liverpool got beat 4-1 last year, they went in the Champions League game, that area of the pitch, they were funnelling down that side the whole time, and Liverpool got ripped apart. But Klopp stayed there. I said about being compromised, he won't be compromised. And eventually it paid off for Liverpool. And I do think it says a lot, because Trent's been around now a long time. He's 25. I have to remind myself that now Trent is a 25-year-old. And he's gone for a lot as a wing-back, come full-back. Can he play other positions? I think he's a massive talent that somehow, like Saturday, there ain't many people who can deliver that moment to get a 1-1 draw at the Etihad and take a ball. We talked about great goals earlier. Trent's first touch.
First touch is beautiful.
And then to hit it with his right foot. There's very few footballers who can do that. You know, instant touch, strike straight away, bottom corner, Edison, world-class goalkeeper. Yeah, and just one final point. The game was there for City to literally win 2-3. They didn't take their chances. Liverpool kept in it and got a reward by a moment of brilliance.
Do you think that makes Liverpool more content with the result, Alison? Of the two teams?
Completely. I mean, I think never in my life ever have I said, "Oh, I'll take the draw." Took the draw, because we'll beat them at the Anfield, and that means we've won the title. That's how I see it.
Bit of trolling to finish the
thought. But it was a game that lacked oomph, and the pitch was slow, so they all looked like they were running in treacle.
I do think
both managers were happy with the draw as well.
Do you buy into that? I was astounded the Premier League wanted to go with 12:30 for two teams that have been on international duty, got players all over the world playing their football, and come back and then go, "You're the early game." I thought it should have been the Sunday game for me.
Of course
me.
It should.
Yeah. You know, without a doubt, it should be the Sunday game.
Finally, Arsenal. Because Arsenal have somehow gone to the top of the league and seem to be going under the radar a little bit. James Gearbrandt's written about this in The Game today. The title is "Arsenal Building this Title Bid Out of Scrap and Metal." he's pointing out last season the average Arsenal game featured 3.45 goals, which was the second most in the league, and that 12 of the 38 games, so nearly a third, had more than 5 goals. And this season, they're yielding 2.85 goals. So it's like, although for a team that's accused of being emotional or over emotional sometimes, it doesn't really fit the narrative. There's more control this year.
The most, honestly, when they go to the managers after a game, I mean, unless the manager just kicks off because they're called Roberto De Zerbi, it is usually quite boring. But it was the most interesting Mikel Arteta has ever been post match for me. Because the interviewer, I think this was BBC, the interviewer said, you a bit like you've just described, really. You weren't yourselves, but, you know, it's good to win, isn't it, when you're not playing your best football. And Arteta says, "You don't play good football here." And that was so illustrative of how they have grown up under Arteta, because, of course, they went to Brentford, lost, and under the Friday night lights, and then lost the next two games. And his tenure, that was Brentford's first game in the Premier League, and his tenure was in doubt. You know, how embarrassing, Brentford's first game in the Premier League, and they completely wipe the floor with you. And he's learned that you do go to certain grounds and you don't try and play attractive football. You stick in there, you keep organised, you keep your shape. You know, you work out what you're going to be facing, and Brentford do it very well. And I think most neutrals would have thought, "Oh, Brentford were a bit unlucky." Actually, there was that mix up at the back, and you thought, "Why? How on earth did you know?" When Ramsdale lost the ball, you thought that. I mean, Brentford really should have scored, but it's cleared off the line. And in that sense, Brentford were unlucky. But we know what Brentford are, and there is almost no narrative about them now, because they're so consistent. The narrative is about how Arsenal have grown up in that period since they were beaten by Brentford, in that they learnt that Arteta's not afraid to be boring. He's not afraid to say 1-0 to the Arsenal is absolutely fine.
Boring Arsenal.
Isn't it interesting that Arteta, I mean, I think this is one of the reasons to bring in Declan Rice in this type of game, you know, making it really difficult in midfield areas. And but then you had at Anfield last week, and the week before international duty, and Jurgen Klopp spoke about Brentford and talked about that's what sort of team I wanted, someone everybody hated to play. They'd done the double over Man City last year. You know, that is an incredible achievement. It's one of the best achievements you'll have from any club, to do a double over a team like them who ended up winning the treble. And that is the problem that Brentford will give you. Brentford weren't at their best. You know, they were off it a bit because Arsenal wouldn't let them be at their best. You know, there was a massive difference from the start of the last season that Alisson, the game's referring to, when it's a 3-0 game, where you just ask for trouble. If you get it wrong against Brentford, you're going to be in serious trouble because they will dominate in their way of playing. So you have to, in some way, even though you're a grander club and riches of big transfers and high-wage players and all this, in some way you have to say, today you've got to play like you're a FA Cup team from the League Two up against Brentford to try and stop them, but you can beat them by doing that. And that's how they got over the line. They got over in a game that all Arsenal game fans will forget.
Yeah.
Because it wasn't a classic, but it didn't show you any. If you had said afterwards, this team could be fighting and winning to the title, Arsenal, and point at them, they'd be saying, no chance. You know, it felt like a team in the bottom half of the table match between two of them. But that was the way that Arteta felt that he had to go, I'm sure.
1-0 to the Arsenal, becoming a familiar scoreline again. And I think if it takes Arsenal to the title, they will not care. Anyway, thank you. That's all I've got time for today. Alison Rudd, Tony Cascarino and Tom Olnett, thank you for joining me. If you enjoyed the show, make sure you're subscribed, leave us a review, and we'll be back on Thursday.
The train is now approaching. Junction at platform. Passengers, airport, please stay on board. Next stop, Road Station.
iOS helps you control which apps you share your exact location with. There's more to iPhone.
Hey marketers, advertisers, and business owners. Find yourself chatting up the same audience in the same places, using the same old lines? Maybe it's time to podcast the net further to catch your next customer. With Acast, there's plenty of fish in the sea with more than 100,000 podcasts and millions of listeners. So there's a perfect match for every business. Use our ad platform to cast your net, then narrow down using targeting such as demographic, show categories, audience segments, and more. Find your match, then reel them in. Advertise on more than 100,000 podcasts with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.